Ladies and welcome to Radio Free Nintendo. This is episode 375. I'm your host, Jonathan Metz, and with me as always are John Lindemann.
It is great to be here, Johnny.
Good to have you, man. James Jones.
Is it just ladies' night tonight?
Uh-huh.
It must be.
Every night.
I feel like it's going to be kind of empty.
Speaking to that empty room also is return of our good buddy, Mr. Guillaume Vaillette.
I might be distracted tonight because there's like a political debate going on right now in Quebec, and we're in the last period, and the Parti Québécois pulled their goalie, and it's really exciting.
What's amazing about that is it is both the most Canadian thing that's ever been said on the show that's had two Canadian panelists for over a year, and also just complete gibberish.
But it's also completely plausible within the bounds of reality.
Yeah, it's Quebec political debate settled on the ice.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Oh, beautiful.
All right, guys.
You still there?
No, you didn't lose. Well, you lost me, but you didn't. You didn't lose me on the call. All right. Sorry, I was completely confounded by what just happened. All right. So, Guillaume, we missed you last week, but it's good to have you back, man. And I know you've got a lot to talk about. And actually, I think coming up later in the show, we're going to do a few special topics. We'll see how much time they take. We've got some listener mail, if time allows, afterward. But let's catch up real quick with Guillaume's new business.
Yeah, I've been busy playing a lot of games. I've been busy kind of quitting on Bravely Default, I'm sorry to say. Well, I wouldn't say I quit on it. I would say that I reached an ending, and to me, it's like it's the ending of the game. You know, if anyone knows, well, a lot of people, I think, have finished this game by now. But yes, there's kind of a way to get an ending before you actually reach the end of the game. And to reach the actual end of the game, you have to wade through a lot of bullshit. So I decided, Guillaume, you know, you're not going to do that. And you're just going to take the first exit that comes up.
The ending in question is basically everybody looking around going, that doesn't feel like that was the ending.
Yeah.
I feel like that's not really the ending. And the game goes, we're going to put you back before you made that terrible decision to end the game. Let you continue from there. You should do that. And it's like, okay, game.
Oh, so right. It's not a situation where you kind of need to know where the divergence is, and you need to know to save before that. In other words, the game.
No, the game puts you back.
Okay, right. So when there's no harm in taking the easy way out. Like, it's still going to encourage you to go back and do it the right way.
And in fact, you unlock stuff for taking the easy way out, as it were, that you don't unlock for beating the full ending. So there's value in doing both.
It's funny, actually, that's almost the exact premise for all of Radiant Historia.
Right.
Except that those endings come fast and furious, and this ending comes furious. Yeah.
Now, this concerns me, Guillaume. I mean, this is like, it's not exactly like this, okay? But it's a little bit like someone getting to the easiest, blandest, kind of worst, shortest ending in Chrono Trigger, and then saying, well, I don't really want to, I know there's more endings. I just don't care to go back and try any of them because I don't like this game enough to keep playing it. And you can't imagine anyone saying that about Chrono Trigger. Like, when you finish the game in this way, it should leave you wanting more. It should leave you excited to go back and do things a different way and to get something a little bit extra out of it.
Yeah, but the ask in Chrono Trigger is completely different.
Yeah.
That's the problem. I mean, so Johnny, how far have you gotten in the game?
I am finally – actually, I think I'm at the very end of Chapter 4.
So okay. That is the fourth crystal.
I might even be at the very beginning of Chapter 5, but I'm back on the airship. I'll put it that way.
And you don't have any idea what getting to the end of the game actually entails.
Yeah, well, you don't know how much more of this you're going to have to go through.
No.
Put it that way.
Okay.
No. The big story flip or whatever, it hasn't happened yet, but I get the sense that I am like right on the cusp of it.
You've awakened all four crystals?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, you're at the edge.
Right.
The abyss, the edge of the abyss.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the thing is, like, there's a thing that you can do, that I tried to do before it actually gives you a fake ending and it wouldn't let me. And then I did it again after, you know, chapter 4, and then it worked, and I fought N and boss, and that's right. Just good enough for me. Like, I was ready to be done with the game, and when I read people saying, like, okay, well, like, the game was good for 30 hours, and then I played for 70 hours, and it was not so good for the rest of the 40 hours. I don't want to go through that.
That's not very enticing.
I would say it does piece itself back together for like the last 10.
That's not a very interesting carrot there.
I'm just saying
it'll be 30 hours not, suck in between that.
It's not accurate to say that the game never pulls it back together, because it does. Okay. It does make a really good effort to say, all right, all that shit I put you through, I understand it's some shit, and we all know it is, and even the characters are like, man, this kind of sucks. Right. But here's why I had to do it. Look at all this story stuff I'm pulling together.
Okay, abusive husband, bravely default.
Yeah, well, but he bought you a diamond, John!
I want no part of this.
She didn't mean anything.
If we get back to the comparison with Chrono Trigger, I think the main difference here is that I was actually invested in the characters of Chrono Trigger, and I liked the story, and I had the feeling, like, the Chrono Trigger is a very tight game. There's not a whole lot of filler. There's maybe one or two areas that I don't like, but the rest is really, really fun. And in Bravely Default, it's not that. There is filler. There is a lot of back and forth, like, pointless quests, and the characters I don't especially like, and I'm not that interested.
Every single scene is told with about five times as many words as are necessary to convey what's going on in the story and what's going on with the characters. So I'm getting to where if it's not like if it doesn't look like a really critical story event, I'll just skip it.
You said that like four episodes ago.
I just want to keep playing. I mean, when you play a story, this goes back to the very beginning of RPGs, especially back in the 16-bit era where the localization actually got up to speed for most of us. If you're going to build a game that's 40 or 50 hours long, you have to have a strong story. You have to engage the player. You have to be able to get people interested to keep their attention for that long. This is not anything new. This is not us, you know, growing, aging ADD gamers who don't have time, just, you know, busy people. This goes back since the 80s. If you're going to make a game this long, you have to keep people engaged through the story. That is the way RPGs do it. And Bravely Default lost me so early, you know, and this is a problem I have with, like, the Paper Mario series. I think those games are super cute. I do not care about the plots in those games. They're way too shallow. They're way too repetitive. They're way too vaudeville or whatever you want to call it, but it just doesn't appeal to me strongly enough. It's not good enough. It's one reason I like the first Mario and Luigi game so much better, because I actually thought that was hilarious. Like, I thought that was legitimately a great story, which Paper Mario lacks, and that's why I like that game better. So a game like Bravely Default, you know, if you've within the first 10 hours, I was checked out of the story. I said, I don't want to hear these people talk. I don't want to read what they have to say. It's bad. I don't like it.
And, you know, this is supposed to be kind of a throwback to old school RPGs, but old school RPGs were not 70 hours long. They were, Final Fantasy game was like 20, 30 hours. Chrono Trigger,
he's
about
right.
30. I would say, like, Phantasy Star, maybe 40. But just, no, like, you did not have 70-hour RPGs, or if you did, they're not the ones that people remember, you know?
Yeah.
And they didn't have 15-minute-long dialogue scenes.
No.
I'm not exaggerating there. I mean, this game is ridiculous.
Wow.
There's a lot of, because it has that autoplay, I'll get to a cutscene and just set it down and go do something else and come back.
That's brutal. Later. You should never want to make the player do that. That's awful.
Yeah. It's just, I don't like the storytelling. I like the game so much otherwise, but it's really, in an RPG, this is a very serious issue. I mean, I really like Bravely Default, and I would recommend it to a lot of people if you like the mechanics of a JRPG, and if you want to see one of the best presentations on the 3DS yet, graphically and in the music, they're just spectacular, but, you know, it's very hard for me to unconditionally recommend an RPG with what I think is a pretty terrible story. Mm-hmm. That's rough. You know,
And the thing is, I've had people on Twitter tell me, no, like, the people who played for 70 hours, they did all the side quests and they didn't need to, and you can just rush through to the ending and do a little bit of grinding and you're going to be okay. And I was like, okay, I picked the game back up and I went to an area that I could grind, but already, like, I had lost all interest. I was already checked out, you know, like, I thought, no, I'm ready to move on. And, yeah, I'm probably not going to go back to the game.
It's finished for you. It's not finished for me. I haven't reached the break point yet, so I haven't decided whether I'm going to do like you or try to go James's path and go all the way. I don't know yet. I have played many long RPGs. I can handle it. I've put 100 hours into Dragon Quest VIII and probably 80 hours into Ni No Kuni. I mean, I can handle it. I put 70 into FF13. So I can handle these games, but they have to, I have to like them, you know, and I like all three of the games I just mentioned way more than I like Bravely Default. Yeah. It's good, but it's not in those ranks for me. So I can't say which way it's going to go yet, but I have to say, I mean, as much as I'm complaining about it and all of us have serious reservations about this game, there is so much potential. So much of the game is spectacular. I am so excited to see what they do with the sequel because, you know, and it's tough because storytelling, it usually isn't one of those things you assume will be improved in a further game. In fact, a lot of times the story gets worse, even as a lot of the other parts of the game might get better with that iteration. So I'm very concerned about the future of the series, or at least my level of interest in it, but I'm hopeful that they're going to get this feedback, you know, especially the localization team. I mean, most of my problems could have been dealt with in the localization. I'm not saying they did a bad job because this may be very accurate to the original Japanese version of how this game is told, but I made a joke on Twitter this week and I said, I give it about 5 years before like a fan group does their own like hack homebrew localization of Bravely Default that's like a fifth as long and it'll be a better game. You know,
like the Star Wars movies, the prequels, someone just re-edits
cut it down.
So that would be good.
Streamline this bitch because it's just a big old hog right now, and it's not that much fun. I mean, the story isn't. So I think, you know, you could do a lot better job of this if you had the freedom to do so. And I don't know that was the choice. It may not have been up to the localization team, but I hope that they get some feedback on all this from us and a lot of other people who feel similarly. And I hope, you know, with the sequel, if it does come over, I think it will with the sales that we saw for the first one. I hope they'll do something very different with it, you know?
Yeah. And, you know, like the job system was fun. And, as I tweeted before getting to the end that I got, I said, well, whatever happens next, I enjoyed this game for 30 hours and I did. So it's, I don't think it was a waste of money. I don't think it was still a good purchase and I still had a good time. But then, you know, there was a point where I just didn't want to keep playing it anymore.
I really like the one thing about the job system I haven't heard a lot of people talk about is not just anything to do with the mechanics of it really, but that every job is unlocked by defeating a certain enemy character.
Yeah, that's really interesting, right? Like because you're facing the job that you're trying to get, and they kind of have interesting personalities and
I think those people actually they're kind of like the Metal Gear Solid bosses, you know, like a lot of times they're the most memorable characters and they're some of the craziest also over the top for sure.
And at the same time, they're kind of Mega Man bosses because you kill them and you steal their powers.
Right. Yeah. So it's a weird element to include in a JRPG, but I think it works really nicely. And it makes the process of going around and collecting these 30 jobs or 25, whatever it is, but it makes it a lot more exciting. It gives you a better sense of progression and it makes it feel more integral to the game. It's not like you're just walking around picking up crystals in the woods, like in, you know, FF7 or something like that. So you can, I guess what I want to say is, the other thing I wanted to point out, I remember now, the other point that I had was that, you know, sometimes you'll go up against characters who are pretty important to the story. Like people, I'm getting to the point now where I've fought some characters who've been around for a long time. Some, you know, the bad guys. Cause you get these glimpses into into their plotting machinations and stuff like that. Ni No Kuni did a similar thing. But I'm getting to where I'm fighting those people now, and they have interesting relationships with my main group of characters. And even though I'm not really that invested in the story or the characters, I do think it's really interesting, like, to go up to one of your characters' parents in battle and you know, have to defeat him, and at the same time feeling excited for my chance to become the awesome job class that he appears to be. You know, like, it sets the enemy characters apart so much. It's kind of like the whole Koopa Kids thing, the Koopalings, because each one is given a personality that otherwise in a game like this, the bosses might all kind of blend together in a certain way. But because they're all different jobs, they all kind of stand out. You might not even remember that the one Red Mage's name, but you remember who he is because that was the Red Mage side quest, you know? So if you didn't get the job from it, that side quest wouldn't have been as memorable. And if you didn't have to go through a side quest and meet this character and defeat him to do it, then the job wouldn't be as meaningful to you. You know what I mean?
I would say, on a personal standpoint, I don't agree with the vehemence that you hold for the distaste of the story.
I understood. Yeah. I mean, you and I have different tastes when it comes to video game stories.
I found the storytelling in Ni No Kuni to be far more frustrating. Because it felt a lot of times like, hey, here's a little bit of story, now go do a bunch of crap, and then maybe come back and we'll give you another couple seconds of story.
Yeah, but I was okay with that because it did leave me wanting more. In general, when the story kicked up, I was interested in what was happening.
A lot of times for me, it felt like they're just like, we're going to give you the bare minimum we can give you, and you know, I just go, fuck this, I'm not dealing with this crap.
Anyway, so I've been playing Bravely Default. I've also, we finished over here in co-op, Donkey Kong Country Tropical Freeze. And this game is really a single-player game, isn't it? we beat the boss that Johnny was complaining about maybe 3 weeks ago. The one that jumps in the background and you can't really hit him. And he's really a bastard. He's really frustrating. Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. And when you're playing two players, he's kind of designed so that once you do have the opportunity to jump on his back and do damage, he'll raise his head and the second player basically has no chance and must take a hit. It's really, really weird. This game is really hostile to co-op playing, and I don't understand it.
I understand it. It's because of the forward propulsion that we've talked about in the level design. Mm. You're going to leave someone behind almost immediately, almost all the time. It's just both players have to be playing with almost exactly the same level of skill and at the same pace, which is not necessarily the case. You might have good players who play the game really fast and people who just play it very slowly because there's no timer. So you can play the game slowly and do well, but you can't mix and match those people in two players. So, I mean, I agree with you. The game, it supports two player and that works, but it doesn't really, in most cases, make the game more fun.
Yeah, and this particular boss battle, like, it's like they made sure that his move would hurt the second player. Like, it was designed this way. So it's not just a result of the forward momentum. It's really like, okay, well, there's two of these guys. Let's really make sure that one of them really hates the time that they're having right now.
There's probably a way to avoid it, but it's definitely made so that you are more than likely going to get hit.
Yeah, so, you know, like the girlfriend now is done with the game, and she found it really frustrating. I'm going back to the levels that I haven't unlocked, and I've done the first two temple levels, and I'm enjoying it more now. Like, it's just now I can go, you know, at my own pace and really rush through the levels, and that's the way they're meant to be played. So it's much more enjoyable than just jumping into pits, not being sure, like, okay, like losing sight of your character momentarily and looking at the other one and like, oh shit, I just threw myself in a pit. I thought for sure that I was controlling the other one, and having the platform dissolve because the other person went on it first and you didn't have time to reach it.
Right. Another great reason that this game really doesn't support two players very well in the level design.
But in single player, like, it is difficult, and I'm dying a lot, but suddenly lives aren't a problem anymore. I'm not bleeding them. I'm always, you know, gaining more lives as I play, so it's not a problem. And it's just, Yeah, like it feels like, okay, finally I'm playing the game the way it's meant to be played.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's a fun time. And lastly, I got last week, they released Adventure Island 2 on the eShop, on the 3DS eShop. And something that you might not know about me, for a brief while, I was just addicted to Adventure Island. It's completely inexplicable. I was just...
The first one?
The whole series. It started... Really? Yeah, like
we're a connoisseur. I did not know this.
See, the thing is, for Halloween, I could totally see you dressed up as Master Higgins. Totally.
Shut up. no, it was like a game club, a Nick of the World. Like there was, we decided to do a double feature with Wonder Boy and Adventure Island, and these two games are supposed to be the same game, and in many ways they're very similar. You know, except for the art that changes and the. Wonder Boy is a Sega Master System game. It's a little bit more colorful. But yeah, like these two games are...
It's a little bit like Doki Doki Panic to Super Mario Brothers 2.
Right. These games are basically developed by the same team who retained the rights for the level design but didn't have the rights to the characters. Sega had the rights to Wonder Boy. So they were like, hey, Hudson, how would you like a game that we already made? And, you know, you can put a fat guy on it or anything. And... Hudson put a fat guy in it, and so
they like, toyed with the hedgehog, and they said, "Oh, we can't do that. Let's do something else then."
No, yeah, but except that Wonder Boy is really, really plays well, and the levels are brisk, and they're really well designed. And somehow in the conversion, the first Adventure Island, all the timing got, I don't know, like all the timing got worse. All the enemies have been slightly misplaced so that to make sure to troll you every time that you feel is the right time to jump, it's not the right time, and you're gonna land right. Straight on an enemy, and it's just the most frustrating and probably the toughest game that I finished. So you know, I've never finished Battletoads, but I finished Adventure Island, and it's definitely the toughest game that I finished.
You know, mine.
Hmm.
Mine would be Mylan's Secret Castle.
Oh well. Yeah, so
I just want to get a drop of that in there, especially since we're talking about Hudson.
Right.
Whenever I can.
So speaking of Hudson Kuzoge, but anyway, the Adventure Island 2. The rest of the series is really, the rest of the series is really not bad. Super Adventure Island on the Super Nintendo is really good. My favorite is probably New Adventure Island on the TurboGrafx 16, and Adventure Island 2. Is really nice. It was also on the NES, and all the problems with the first one have been fixed. The game is much more colorful. It's much prettier. The enemies aren't there to troll you, and you can also get dinosaur buddies way before Mario got one. So it's pretty neat. You've got these different types of power ups. Like you've got, I think, four different. Dinosaurs, and one of them is, you know, underwater one, so it helps you in the underwater levels, and you've got a, I can't say these words, Pteranodon?
Oh, yeah.
Anyway, a flying dinosaur, and so it's really neat, much more diversity in power-ups, and you've even got some, like, secret exits. You can skip whole worlds. You've got really cool secrets, although the game, very much in the vein of a Donkey Kong Country Tropical Freeze, is all about forward momentum. Really, like, you always constantly go to the right as fast as you can, because your health is also a timer. It goes down as you go through the level. And you need to keep collecting these fruits until you reach the end of the level. So, you know, it's very fast-paced. And one of the power-ups that you get is a skateboard. And when you get it, then the game actually turns into an auto-scrolling platformer.
Right. So, and the skateboard was the king of video game power-ups for a very brief time period when Adventure Island was, you know, in its heyday. And I can remember... that was on the cover of the box. It was Master Higgins, the little guy with his hula skirt, riding a skateboard. And I can remember immediately wanting to play that. But you have to remember, this was in like 1988. So skateboarding was the coolest thing in the universe. I mean, every kid wanted to have a skateboard, even if you had absolutely no idea how to use it. Mm-hmm. It was just, it was, you know, the Ninja Turtles rode on skateboards. So, yep. You know, it was
kids
just
were fucking stupid. The 80s.
It was shorthand for hey kids, this is awesome. You will love this.
What do you care, John? You were old by the 80s, weren't you?
It was a long decade. All right.
If Adventure Island had been made a couple of years later, he would have been wearing inline skates and
oh, totally, you know. Absolutely,
oh yeah,
much
oh,
like Shoulder Sonic the Hedgehog,
knee and elbow pads. There you go. Yeah. Yep. He'd have been Poochie.
Yep, exactly.
But yeah, no, I can totally recommend Adventure Island 2. Even if you've been traumatized as a child by the first game, this is completely different. It's a much better game and very fast paced, very challenging, but in a good way. So definitely check it out.
That sounds awesome. I might do that. You know, I was always holding out for Adventure Island 3, and I don't think it ever came to the Wii Virtual Console.
And neither did this one. Yeah, I was waiting for this one for a long time.
Oh, wow. This is new to the 3DS.
Yes.
So, okay. For the first time available. Mm-hmm. That's really exciting. So, yeah, maybe I will check this out. But the third one, I don't know if you ever played that one back in your Adventure Island crazy days, but that one from the screenshots in Nintendo Power was the one that interested me the most because it looked like they had slowed it down a little bit and had made the game structure more nonlinear. So kind of like I was thinking like Wario Land 3 or maybe 2 might be a better comparison. I don't know if it's still broken up into levels, but you know, there was more up and down, left and right movement. I think it, you know, is not so much of an auto run or like super fast paced game. The Dino Buddies are in there, but they let you get into like secret places, and that just always sounded awesome to me. I always wanted to play it when I was a kid, and to this day I don't think it's ever been re-released in America. So hopefully that's coming too.
Yeah, the Adventure Island series is really weird, and the Wonder Boy series is weird as well. And they've had this parallel evolution, and Wonder Boy went in kind of a Zelda 2 direction, and eventually in Super Adventure Island 2, Master Higgins is wielding a sword, and he's got a shield, and you're killing enemies in on a 2D plane. Like, yeah. It's absolutely like complete shift and just coincidentally like completely copying Wonder Boy. So it's
I could never keep these, especially, you know, when they kind of split up like that, because didn't Wonder Boy become Wonder Boy in Monster Land, and then Wonder Boy in Monster Land just became Monster Land?
Yeah. Oh, stop. It's super confusing. And there's reports
Was it Monster World 4 or Wonder Boy 4 that you talked about probably about a year ago?
All those games are the same thing. Like,
I know. It's like I would see screenshots of things on three different consoles, and I would look at them and be like, this is the same damn game, but one's called Wonder Boy and Monster Land, one's called Monster Land, one is called Monster World.
Like, yeah, and one of them is on the Sega Master System, one of them is on the TurboGrafx CD, and it's just a clusterfuck. And they were almost all released on the Wii VC, so you really had to have like the family tree next to you and
Chris
to be Kohler able to
used
make
to
sure
do that on Game Life. He would put up the weird like Monster World, Wonder Boy, Adventure Island, you know, kind of you know, it was crazy. I mean, I loved it. It was like one of these flow charts, you know, if this game has Master Higgins, go down. No, go the other direction and follow a completely different branch. It's awesome.
Maybe we'll get back to this if the listeners care. But Adventure Island 2, it's really good.
Maybe Chris will update his graph now that this one's available finally. All right, man. Sounds good. So, James, you're groaning over there, and I want to hear more because I heard that you don't like Yumi's Odd Odyssey.
Yeah.
How could you?
Is that the name of it? Yumi's Odd Odyssey? Is that really what they called it?
For whatever reason, they said, we're going to localize this name.
The hell?
But we're going to. So, it's in Japan, it's Sayonara Umihara Kawase, which I can understand not using that name. But Yumi's Odd Odyssey is also a terrible name.
Yeah,
so
it's not a huge trade up, is it?
So good job, Natsume. Just doing what you do. So if you haven't been following this game, and of course, why wouldn't you have been? Because it's been delayed 47 times. The idea of this game—idea is a strong word. It's a platformer where you go over gaps and climb up walls using a fishing rod that you can cast out that clings to walls and pull yourself up or lower yourself down and swing to some degree. and you're trying to get to doors ethereally floating in space. That is the game. That is the whole of the game. That is the entirety of the gameplay.
Yeah, I think it's kind of a speedrunning thing, right? There are online leaderboards and...
Yes, for some reason. That use whatever name you want to put in there. So please, to quote the disclaimer, don't put anything illegal or that may violate others' trademarks. So don't name yourself Mickey Mouse. Or do name yourself Mickey Mouse, because that will be hilarious. Regardless.
Please don't.
I don't care. I'm not the one who's going to get slapped with an NDA. Or not an NDA, a cease and desist. The basic game itself is you go to these stages and you clear them. And some of them have secret exits that let you access other stages. But the core game of itself, I used the word core in that it's the game's the... If you find no secret exits, the game is 9 stages long. Which is just pretty brutal, because the game's like 30 stages long total. So it'd be good if they put a little bit more access into there. The problem is, I know where the 2 secret exits I have access to are. I just can't get to them. And the reason is that I find that a lot of times the physics in this game is somewhat non-deterministic. So... What? What? I can discuss determinism here. We're all adults.
It's just a great word. I just... All right.
It's computer scientists coming out. So what I mean by that is I'll do the same jump, and as near as I can tell, I did the exact same thing, but the cord of the fishing line bounces more one time, I don't seem to have much control over the pendulum motion that Yumi's taking, or maybe she clings to the wall a little bit differently and doesn't swing as far. So I never feel like what I'm trying to accomplish, I'm getting any better at. It just feels like when I get further, I just got luckier that time.
Wow.
So right now I'm dealing with a stage where you have to get, basically, to get to the secret exit, you have to essentially climb a vertical wall. And it's got ledges that pop out, which require you to sort of work around the ledge, which means you have to cause yourself to swing out and bounce up. So then try to launch the cable diagonally in mid-flight, early enough that you still hit the wall before you fall too far and grab it. But when that doesn't feel like I can replicate that same jump over and over again, and I have to do it like 7 times to get up the wall, that's not a good feeling.
That sounds really hardcore.
It's incredibly difficult.
Yeah.
And I understand that the game is supposed to be really hard. It feels
like... Do you,
like...
though?
Yeah,
you really understand.
I do, actually. It feels like more than 9 of the stages should be, you know, accessible to play a player who buys the game and isn't able to clear those 2 hurdles to get to the secret exits that are immediately available. That's all I'm saying. I'm saying 9 stages at the very beginning, all of which are tutorial stages, is pretty brutal.
Yeah.
Because it never actually explains how to do this wall climb thing that you have to do to get to the 2 secret exits I have access to right now.
It's left for you to discover. I kind of like that idea. I don't know that I'm going to enjoy it in execution. I've already bought this game. I've played it for 30 seconds. And just in case people haven't quite grasped what's going on here, the way I would explain it is it's kind of like Bionic Commando, but with physics instead of like pre-canned animations. So
it's as if the arm of Bionic Joe or whatever his name is was elastic.
Yeah.
Like it's a rubber band.
Right. And you kind of bounce off of walls. So I wouldn't call it non-deterministic. That's probably derogatory and maybe accurate, but I don't know for myself yet. But it does feel kind of loose and like it would, there's enough uncertainty in what you're doing that it's going to be tricky to like really dial in very, very specific maneuvers. And there's probably a very high skill ceiling on this, but I like the idea of it in principle. I think it's super interesting. You know, it's a little bit like Portal or, you know, some Spider-Man games that really make good use of his powers where they don't necessarily pre-script the ways for you to get around the environment. They just make sure there's at least enough kind of things in it for you to attach to or for you to, you know, make use of or for you to throw a portal onto that you will find a way to do it. So like in those games, those games do it very well, but in those games, it always feels like it's really been play tested and they made sure that people like, you know, normal people can figure this out. Like, it's not impossible, but it's challenging, and your creativity will sometimes make you feel like you've broken the game when actually that's one of the completely viable expected ways to do it.
I will say with no reservation that the average player would find that to be incredibly difficult.
Mm-hmm.
So, I put it in perspective, I died 42 times trying to get to one of the secret exits.
Okay.
That's a lot of deaths.
And is that just sitting there doing the same thing over and over again?
Yes.
Wow.
I mean, you know, I've had the same thing in Mega Man X. So, again, I mean, this doesn't scare me, although I understand your problems with it.
Yeah. I would say that in Mega Man X, though, it never felt like it was loose. It always felt like if I hit that jump the exact same way, I'm going to get the same result.
Yeah.
I don't feel that way here. And part of it's because it depends on how much slack you've got in her cable. It depends on the exact angle you came in with, how much it bounces. It depends on how far down the wall she hits things. I mean, there's all kinds of weird factors in play that maybe they are, you know, maybe determinism is in play, but it's just not, your brain can't see all the things that are factoring into this jump.
Well, maybe
maybe with enough practice, like you've had this game for an hour or two.
No, I've had this game for about five.
Okay. But yeah. Still, I think that perhaps with enough practice, you will end up knowing pretty much where you're going to land.
Don't think so. I don't. Hmm. Because I still see things where I don't understand at all how it happened. Like she'll just slingshot and I'm like, how the hell did that happen? There was no reasonable explanation for what just occurred happening. And sometimes that's been great for me. Sometimes it's just landed me on the platform I'm trying to get to, and I'm like, all right, the game just broke, but that's fine.
Right.
And sometimes it's just shot me off the side of the screen, and you're done. It's
well,
like, I don't...
slingshotting is just pressing down on the D-pad, right?
Yeah, but it's not the slingshot. It's not that she slingshot. It's how she slingshot. Mm-hmm. Like, she goes off in some really crazy angle that doesn't make any sense from the context.
Wow.
You're just like, okay, game, that was curious.
Well, obviously, you have problems with the physics in this game, but how do you feel the price point works out?
Oh, it's fucking wrong.
This
is 30
bucks.
It's super wrong.
30 bucks.
That price
fairly,
is
you know,
super
for,
high.
I mean, I believe it was a full retail game in Japan, and I believe it's only coming out on the eShop here, right? But
it is.
But they decided to basically keep a similar price. I mean, in Japan, everything's crazy expensive. So a normal retail 3DS game, there's like 50 or 60 bucks brand new.
Yeah.
But
and wow. That's this is really high. I mean, this price is super high for this game. Because if you look at it, if you actually watch it in action,
it doesn't look like much.
It feels
the
like
graphics
a budget.
Are not very good.
I mean, it looks like a budget 3DS game. And it's not like Natsume spent a ton of money localizing all 30 words of text in the game. There is essentially I don't understand the justification for this price. I mean, the only reason I could see pricing it here is because the original publisher of the game in Japan said, no. This is an important game. It needs to be priced as such. I mean, that's the only thing I could think of. They just said, no, it's got to be priced here. So my guess is that Nintendo's philosophy is no casual person is going to see just these pictures, which honestly look, you know, they kind of remind me of Cave Story 3D level of graphics. That's sort of where I'm putting it.
Yeah, I was going to say Klonoa.
Yeah, that's not bad. But like
it's
much
very
less
bright. It's very pink and like,
but,
you know,
but
pastel
basically
green.
No background art. Everything just sort of floats in space. So, I mean, they it feels very just – it feels kind of like a – like one of those pre-rendered SNES games where they would just put these shapes in space. And that's because that's what they could do.
I have to say my first impression was that it looks kind of like Jet Rocket 2. And that's not a good thing. I mean, technically Jet Rocket 2 might actually be more impressive because it does have a nice engine. Like it's using a lot of impressive visual effects, but the art of that game is not good. You know, that game has no personality at all.
And the other thing I have for the game is just feels kind of sluggish, just personally, but.
Oh yeah, like she's very slow, and not only that, but she's got on an incline. She's got the physics of Sonic.
Yeah.
Like if you're slightly inclined, you're gonna jump the other way. You know, like you're gonna be facing left, but the incline is a little bit to the right. You're gonna jump right.
Yeah, it just doesn't feel like it works. I mean, you sit there and you're like, oh. So I know, like, they made, what was it? God, they spent a whole bunch of time talking about how, well, if you run down a slope, you'll slide. And it's like, okay. And you'll go faster and you can jump farther. Okay. Could you go faster regularly, please? That'd be cool. But the problem is the departure. When you get down to a situation where you're, how do I describe it? Where you're playing, the like wall climbing part, where you've got to be real, real on top of it. And like you have to not, like everything is real fast. And in fact, they have with the shoulder button, you can slow the game down for a split second to try to make a decision. Although I don't find that it works that it's that much of use. It's such a departure because it's so quick and then everything else is so super slow. It makes getting back to the point of reattempting the jump more painful than it needs to be.
Just harping on her walking speed though might be missing the point because you're supposed to be using the hook all the time, basically. Like already in the first few levels, you can see that there's a couple of shortcuts that you can take.
Yeah, there
and
are.
You can, you can use her rod to just like spring yourself to a higher place, and she's very fast when she's just whipping about, you know.
Yeah, but that's what I'm saying. It's such a departure when she's not flying around that it can be kind of like, what are we doing now?
Okay, you just gotta learn how to learn to control. You gotta learn. Ah, fuck. You gotta learn. So learn.
No. Learn to play.
Learn how to control her in midair. Like it's all about.
I'm saying you gotta teach a man to fish. So give him a fishing pole and have him use it to attach the platforms and get to the other side.
I would say the point is that the game doesn't give you enough to go off of to get to the stuff that you paid for. I feel like if you put this in front of the average person who plays video games, they would give up before they got to those secret exits.
But that's at $30, it's gonna. Yep. This is a niche game that's gonna sell to the people that really want it. So I think that they're gonna put the time in and they're gonna really master.
Well, they're gonna
game.
Put the time in because they dropped $30 on it.
Well, yeah, but sometimes you know, like that kind of helps appreciate a game if you paid 30 cents, then you play for 30 seconds, and you're...
Thank you, Iwata.
It's all about value.
No, seriously, like sometimes some games require more effort to learn.
Fractured Soul kind of followed a similar principle in that they priced that game at about 12 or 15 bucks, I think, when it first came out on the 3DS eShop, and a lot of people were like, you know, this is either too short, or a lot of people just felt it's basically too hard and too frustrating, and a lot of people are never going to see all of it because it's just so brutal. And they said, well, the people who buy our game know what they're getting into. I mean, that's what they want. That we made the game for the people who are going to go super hardcore and speed run it and get every single nook and cranny and get every single little secret thing. And that's our fan base. I'm thinking, you guys don't have a fan base. This is your first game. Yeah. Nobody knows who the fuck you are. How are you assuming your audience on this level? That is so specific to think that, you know, people are going to be willing to play through a level 20 or 30 times. On basically every single level because you've made it so remarkably difficult. You don't think you're going to catch some people by surprise? You know, people who think, oh, this is cool. There's a platformer that uses both screens. And, you know, I wonder if Yumi's Odd Odyssey is kind of the same thing here where it's like, yeah, this is appeals to like an extremely narrow fan base, but nobody here knows what this is. In Japan, this is a whole series. Like you would probably know what this is if you're going to buy it. But here, I mean, right. I bought it because I heard it was cool. I don't know what the hell's going on in this game, you know? I mean, I dropped the $30 because I figured, you know, Danny Bivens is a smart guy and we agree on a lot of games, but not everything.
And he's failed us.
I think that's the ultimate message here.
I have not decided yet for the record.
That's the point I have, though. It's like the idea of, well, we're pricing it higher, so only the people who really know what they want are going to buy the game. That's fucking idiotic.
It is.
It's like saying, if you make a bad decision, we're going to make sure it was a really bad decision.
Yeah, your impulse buy will really come back to kick in the nuts.
It's like, no, we're going to make this car super expensive, but also really impossible to control because that way.
I don't think that the whole, like, you have no fan base argument and the whole people don't know what this game is argument, so it's not going to sell at $30 are kind of flawed because 75% of this, of us have bought this game already. It's the first day.
let me state, well, because we were talking about it in an email thread, too. I'm sure that that at least spurred some of us to buy the game, or at least contributed. Let me put it to you this way. This game at $30 will not sell what it would have sold at $12.
Hmm.
Period. Yeah. I believe that wholeheartedly, and I believe within a year this game will be less, much less than $30 on the eShop.
Well, yeah, well, that's how sales work.
There's a lot of people who just don't like to spend $30 on games, ever. All right, so pretty harsh early impressions of Yumi's Odd Odyssey, but I bet we'll be coming back to that because Guy is just starting it, and I really haven't played it at all yet. So,
but you both already bought it.
Yeah, so we'll definitely talk about it next week or the week after that. So anyway, let's move on to, I guess, pretty quickly what John's been playing or.
Nothing.
All right, John. So we'll hear more from you next week, but I guess I'll wrap up new business. Among other things, I've been trying to finish a lot of games, but I've also been trying to get into a workout routine. Now that the weather's warming up a little bit around here, I'm finally settled into my apartment. I've really got it, you know, pretty feature complete in terms of what I want it to be, the setup, all the furniture and everything. And that's a long process when you start from literally nothing. I mean, I moved into this apartment with two cardboard boxes and a couch. So it's come a long way. I've really settled into it. And I'm like, I can finally kind of get into a routine. And for me, a lot of that, I need a routine in order to do workouts because it's not something that comes naturally to me. So this week, finally, I've kind of gotten back into We Fit You. It had kind of, lain fallow for a while. The balance board wasn't getting much love for 2 or 3 months there. And, you know, I played it a good bit when it first came out back in November, December, but, it had been a while, and I booted it back up and really kind of fell in love with it all over again. I mean, I don't think it's amazing, but it's so different than anything else I do. And it really is a nice feeling just to be active, even when the weather's cold outside. You know, that's a big one for me. That's a big advantage of Wii Fit is that I don't have to go outside. I don't even have to put on shoes to do Wii Fit, and I can still get my heart beating a little bit. And, but I've been doing some running actually, and I am so adamantly against running. I think it is the least fun thing that you can do. I think it is like, I know it's good for you and I know people are way into it, but I feel like some of the cult around running is partly because it's so unfun. It's like how people really get behind Kusuge games. Like they know they're bad, but they're so good at them that they kind of try to defend them. And yeah. I feel like that's what running is with people. Like everyone hates it, but if you spend the effort to get really good at it, you wear it like a badge of honor and you kind of evangelize it. Maybe that's just a symptom of how much I absolutely despise running, but I really do hate it very, very much and have for my entire life.
And, I hate it right along with you, Johnny.
Yeah, man. But you know, We Fit You is like, I use this a little bit back on Plus as well, back on the Wii. But I think it makes running more fun and more interesting and less intimidating. You know, for me to get out, by the time I, you know, really get dressed up and put on shoes and go outside and get kind of warmed up and do my stretching and get around the neighborhood, it's kind of a big commitment for me. And a lot of times I get into it and like 3 minutes afterward, I'm already exhausted and I just want to quit. And I think I'm going to push myself because I've gone through all the trouble to get out here and do this and put on this little show for everyone in the neighborhood. I might as well keep going way beyond my tolerance for it. And then I get way too worn out and then I don't want to do it the next day. So one of the nice things about We Fit You is that there are chunks of running as little as 5 minutes. And there's, you know, in the process of doing that, there's characters on the screen. You're kind of following a path. You're waving at people. And it's not that much stimulation, but it might be, you know.
Wait, are you actually waving at people?
No, but your me character does, and the other characters wave.
Oh, okay.
At you.
I thought you had like to wave a Wii remote or something.
No,
ridiculous.
But you know, I've got a bunch of friends' Miis on my Wii U because of Miiverse. And so running through the island and seeing people who I recognize, you know, see Nate Mustafa and I see Greg out there and I see Guillaume. It's fun to kind of see that stuff. And it also has the free run mode where, you can just put on a TV show or a movie or something and keep on running with the game. And actually that works even better with the gamepad than it did. You could do this even in the original Wii Fit, but it was a little tricky. You had to use the Wii remote and it would kind of sound out this metronome sort of rhythm to kind of let you know, that you're still going, that the game's still keeping track and everything. And it would talk to you every now and then. It would say, you're halfway there. It's like, shut up. I'm trying to watch my TV show. With the gamepad, that actually works much nicer because you already have this other display that you can kind of keep track of what you're doing while you're running. And it's meant, very much meant to be used while the TV is on something else, you know. So it's a very natural fit for this game and for the platform. And I find that I'm actually doing the running more than I have in previous versions of the game. And partly it's because of the gamepad. It just, it's a really nice feature, and it works really nicely with that mode that they had already set up. And so it's been a couple days now, because you can tell from my voice, I'm coming down with a little bit of allergies this time of year. But for 4 or 5 days in a row, I was using Wii Fit U, and it felt like I was getting into a groove, like I'm doing more and more. There's so many activities at this point that if you're not already bored of a lot of the stuff that's been in the previous versions, like if this is your first Wii Fit maybe, I think you'll be impressed with the variety. They're, you know, over the course of doing this 3 times, and they really haven't gotten rid of anything. So it's only cumulative. At this point, there are a lot of activities. And you can play the game for days and days and days and days and days and never repeat anything. But then again, if you find one that you really enjoy, you might immediately get the opportunity to play it again, but in a different version that's a little more challenging and has some new elements added. And in the balance games, that's awesome, because it's like a new level. Like, there's new enemies, there's new activities. They might throw in a little new game mechanic that wasn't in the original, like the easy mode. So it feels like you're unlocking something of value when you do well in these games. And it encourages you to keep playing, which, of course, in the case of this game, means it encourages you to keep exercising. And so it really does nicely match into that feedback loop that's really important when you're doing physical activity for health reasons, you know. I liked it in the beginning, but I'm definitely kind of gaining a renewed appreciation for Wii Fit U. And I'm still using the Fit Meter. I take it to work every day, even though, you know, for a while, a lot of times I would kind of log in once a week and I would load up my Fit credits or my Fit Meter miles or whatever. And that might be the only thing I do on it all week. But at least it kept me engaged. It kept that thing available. It kept it out there. And now I'm doing it more like every day. And I still really like that. I'm doing the challenges. I'm climbing the Grand Canyon and the Eiffel Tower, and I'm marching around Paris. And that stuff it's very simple, but it is like a nice tangible kind of progress to doing something as mundane as just walking around with a pedometer in your pocket all day. It's very smartly done. I think they learned some things from, you know, ridiculous experiments like personal trainer walking. And a lot of the other, you know, brain training, I think they've learned a lot, and they've incorporated more of that into the game at this point. So it's a nice package. If you haven't got Wii Fit U already, I mean, I think it's very significantly better than the previous versions of the game. They've added a lot to it, and some of it you may not realize right at first. Some of it's buried a little bit deeper, or it's more about efficiencies. They actually just put out an update this week that now allows you to load up your Fit Meter data as soon as you turn the game on. So you don't have to go through the start menus. You don't have to choose a Mi profile. You don't have to pick it from a menu or anything like that. It's just immediate, and it's really nice. It speeds up the boot up process. It gets you into the game and gets you exercising faster than before. And that stuff, when it's something that is really designed to be used every single day, little changes like that really add up. And I appreciate them. So yeah, it's been kind of a surprising renaissance for me this week.
I need to get back into it, but I'm afraid of the balance. I know that I've gained
Are
weight.
You gonna fall?
No, but I know I've gained weight. So I'm just lately. Ashamed. I'm just ashamed, and I'm in denial. I'm just like, well, as long as I don't look at my weight, I'm good.
Yeah, I
everything
mean,
is fine.
If you've taken off for a while, you can't really put too much stock into the comparison between 3 months ago and now, because so much stuff has happened in your life, you know? So don't beat yourself up over that. I mean, really, the whole goal of Wii Fit is, how are you doing day to day? You know, can you move things in the right direction? And that alone is worthwhile, because if you've been getting less and less healthy over time, Wii Fit doesn't have to be, it's not going to, and look, it's probably not going to create a drastic change in your body shape or your health, but at least it might turn you back very slowly in the opposite direction, or slow down the damage that you're doing to yourself, Guillaume.
All right. That's not encouraging at all, but yes.
I will openly admit I forgot that Wii Fit U existed. I feel like the marketing on this one's been way, way, way quieter than it was on its predecessors.
I agree, but if you remember with the first game, they remarketed it so many times. It was,
oh, I know.
That game would not die because Nintendo would market it in weird times of the year and even.
Oh no, they were selected times of the year.
Yeah, but, you know, unusual, I think. You know, in the summer, there was a lot of it. Like, right around New Year's, you know, like in January, yeah. They would get this weird, yeah. Like, new, brand new ad buy for Wii Fit. It's like, yeah, because people are getting out and they're trying to do exercise, and this is a cheap way to do it. But in the past, I always felt Wii Fit was kind of a curiosity, and it was like a neat experiment, but I never really felt like it was a legitimate workout program. And with Wii Fit U, I'm not going to say they're there, but they're a lot closer. And it is still fun. It is still charming. It is still easy to use. They've retained all the good qualities, but over time, as they've iterated on this series, they have made it more, I think, legitimate. It feels more like you can get a real good workout on here if that's what you're interested in. And if you just want to fart around and play the little skiing games, you can do that too. And it's still really easy. And people still love that stuff. I still get friends who come over to my house and they want to do the ski jump. Like years and like five years later, they want some of that ski jump action. And I'm like, well, how can I say no? It's good for you. You know, like it's not much, but it's, you know, it's a cool thing to pull out and to take turns with.
Chicken suit was Wii Fit.
Yeah, and that's still really fun. Even by yourself.
Is it still in there?
Yeah.
It's totally still, everything's still in there. They haven't really taken anything out. And that game, when you're playing alone, you obviously don't have the same social experience of everyone laughing at you. But that game is actually surprisingly technical because it's very sensitive to the amount of motion and the rhythm that you have and the way that you're pointing. You're controlling that entire character with your body movement. And it's exciting. Like that is my favorite game because it does combine so many different aspects of what Wii Fit is all about. And it does it really, really well. And it's a fun game. Like it's put into a framework that feels like this is actually an awesome mini game with a lot of subtlety to it. There's a lot of different ways that you can play it. And you can feel yourself getting better at it over time because there's a certain skill to it that builds up as you do it over and over again. It's awesome. I wish they were all that good, but you know, even a few that are that good can make a big difference if you keep going back to it. All right, so why don't we take a break? Well, we're going to come back, and we've got a few interesting current events to talk about and maybe a little bit of your emails too.
Here's a quick look at the best original content at our website, now playing at NintendoWorldReport.com.
First up this week, we have a feature. It's the Japan eShop Roundup. You know it, you love it, by Danny Bivens. Another Sega 3D classic is out. It's Fantasy Zone, so unlike most other Sega 3D classics, it is playable. I'm not going to talk about all the other 3DS downloads Japan got, because it's depressing. On the bright side, they're not getting Wii U software either. Share in our misery.
Alright, and we also have an editorial by Neil Ronahan. Why the Wii U needs Nintendo Pennant Chase Baseball. Sports games on Wii U are all about Mario and Sonic, plus Olympics.
Sonic.
The solution, an unreleased GameCube baseball game. Not exactly what Neil is evangelizing, but Neil's solution is for a similar problem from a different era.
We have a review for Cube Tactics on the 3DS eShop by Addison Webb. A downloadable game about cube armies attacking the enemy cube core. It sounds a little bit silly, but apparently this is a strong single-player strategy title with, of course, some multiplayer connectivity issues.
Yeah, the legacy of the Wi-Fi connection. Lastly this week, we have a review of Professor Layton vs. Phoenix Wright Ace Attorney 3DS by Don Koopman. This is, of course, a European review, which isn't an important review because that's where Don lives. Once again, Europe gets a major 3DS title before North America. I refuse to even talk about the game. I won't. Don likes it, but I'm going to sit here in silent protest until NOA fixes this shit.
I think they've said 2014, but yep. Nothing more specific than that.
Yep. Good job. Boy.
So this might be a very long, long advanced preview of, or preview review of Layton versus Wright. So check it out. I know James is not the only one excited about that game, so it's definitely worth reading what Don thought about it. And he liked it, by the way, so it's good news. But you can check out that review and much, much more over at NintendoWorldReport.com. Welcome back to the show, everyone. We may get into some listener mail if time permits a little bit later in this segment, but I wanted to start off with two or three interesting topics that have come up over the past week. And we'll spend a few minutes on these. We'll see how it goes. But I thought it'd be kind of a grab bag feature thing. None of these, you know, would be probably a full feature topic, but I think there's some things to talk about here. So let's start off with something that kind of occurred in an email thread over the weekend. We were prepping for tonight's recording, and James mentioned that he was kind of between games and looking for an RPG maybe to play. And he was trying to think of any, I don't remember if you were trying or if I was trying to think of one that you could do on Wii U.
Well, I said that I had spent 100 hours on the 3DS in a month, and it was
time to rep. Yeah. Time to think about maybe doing something other than 3DS. And I was thinking, are there any RPGs on Wii U? I mean, you don't like Earthbound, and that's the first one that comes to mind. And beyond that, I think there's that eShop game called Unepic, which is kind of an RPG.
There's Breath of Fire 2.
Oh, yeah.
That's right. Which, yeah, but I mean, I've played that game. I love that game, but I've played that game
you love it,
at least 15 times.
Oh, Jesus.
I love that series. And Capcom, by the way, Capcom, if you release the Breath of Fire phone game here, I will find you and I will hurt you. Everyone involved. All of you.
I was just thinking there is really a very, 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 very small selection of RPGs on Wii U, even considering the Virtual Console, which is crazy. Mm-hmm. You know, like with a service like that, you should be able to fill in the gaps of your main console library almost from day one. You know, very easily you should be able, I mean, these games are already localized. It's not like it's any harder to bring out an RPG than it is a platformer on the Virtual Console. It's still a ROM. You don't really have to do anything to it. You just have to, I mean, the testing might be more laborious.
There's some kind of weird special thing that was in the cartridge. Hmm. I mean, it could have been one of those weird, like, extra chip in the cartridge things, but...
But yeah, like I never understood the timing of RPG releases on the Virtual Console because it took such a long time for Chrono Trigger and Final Fantasy III to show up on the service, and we already had a couple of RPGs by that point. It just doesn't it make sense to release your classic RPGs at the beginning of the console lifecycle when there's just not that many that have been made for that system?
Not if you're Square Enix and your thought process was, well, we may sell these as full price retail releases in some weird chopped up form.
Yeah. That seems that's of a bygone era, though. I mean, they can't do that anymore.
No, but they were still kind of doing it back then.
They were
back then, but now they're not. I mean, they're not going to release a new version of Secret. They're not going to release Secret of Mana on a 3DS cartridge the way they did Chrono Trigger back on the DS.
But that was a long time ago. That was their thought process.
At the time, yeah, totally.
Well, I mean, isn't Square Enix putting all these games out on like iPhone right now?
Yeah, they're really busy with that, and I think they just don't seem as interested in Virtual Console anymore.
And it's my understanding those versions really aren't that good.
Yeah, well, Android ones especially are pretty crappy.
Well, like you say, they don't seem to be that interested in Virtual Console, but in Japan, they're getting all those games. Like, as we speak, on the Wii U
and on the 3DS. It's a Western problem.
Yeah, on the 3DS, they're getting the Game Boy games. On the Wii U, they're getting the classic Super Nintendo RPGs and RPGs that we've never gotten here, of course, like the Mana series. The Saga series. It's very frustrating. And I hate Danny Bivens for just rubbing it in our faces.
I feel like we're missing out so much on Saga, but...
I feel like I'm missing out. They were good games.
You're a fan of that series, I understand, but... Yeah, I mean, there are so many Super Nintendo games that I would like to play on my Wii U. You know, both stuff that did and did not come out on Wii. And I don't know what the holdup is. I think a lot of it has to do with the install base. I think it's really hurting us, you know, because it's harder for them to work out the math to make that profitable. But even aside from Virtual Console, which seems like it would be the easiest way to quickly get a lot of RPGs on the system, other than X, is there even anything announced for an actual Wii U
Shin
game?
Shin Megami Tensei Fire Emblem thing.
Okay, sure. Yeah, I mean, it's an strategy RPG, but yeah, sure.
Do we count stuff like Pure Solar or eShop games?
I mean, we may have to for the purposes of this conversation.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know how many of those there are either, but there may be more of those than full retail games at this point, or at least on the way.
Well, we know there are because, like I said, we've done the mental exercise of how many.
Child of Light's release is imminent.
Oh, that's true. Now, that's a really good... Yeah, that's a good pull. I mean, remains to be seen whether that's any good, but I'm very hopeful. You know, I think it looks awesome, so we will see. But, you know, I think it's really sad. It's very telling about the situation with Wii U that, like, South Park didn't come out for it, for instance. Mm-hmm. And that game certainly could run on the Wii U. You know, it's a 360 and PS3 game. There's nothing super technologically advanced about it. I think it would be a fantastic Wii U game. But why would they, you know?
Right.
It's just that's when people are like, well, I don't care how Wii U's selling because Nintendo's making the games for it and that's what I want to play. I mean, I, to an extent, understand that, and I know that some people can be happy with that, but there are kinds of games that Nintendo does not make. And that includes things like sports games I don't care about. It also includes things like RPGs that I do.
Right.
And so when you don't have that third-party support on your system, it makes the catalog anemic and severely so in certain areas. And that's what concerns me about it. And
that's why they bought Monolith Soft. I mean, because those guys
can only make one game every three or four years.
I know, studio, right? I mean, that was a tacit admission of their own.
Absolutely, yeah. But they've got to be able to pull in other companies, and you know, it doesn't even have to be JRPGs like Fallout 4. That ain't coming to Wii U. Forget it, you know. And it probably could, but it really upset me once I realized that this is probably not going to get better, you know. And Guillaume, I know you said something about, well, you know, it hasn't been out that long, or certainly it is true that historically RPGs take longer to appear on a new platform than other genres do.
Yeah.
But Wii U's been out for 18 months. You know, I think when Earthbound is the most prominent RPG release in the first 18 months, and there aren't even many announced.
Johnny, at this point, I think only Eternal Sonata had been released on the 360, like 18 months in. Blue Dragon took two years.
The 360 had no marketplace in Japan, though.
Yeah.
Well, sure. Yeah, but they announced they announced RPGs, exclusive RPGs before Sony did. Sony had for a while fewer Japanese RPGs than Xbox did. So
yeah, there wasn't much out, but at least at that point Microsoft had been promising. Like, they knew people wanted this stuff. They had announced Lost Odyssey and
Infinite Discovery.
Blue
Dragon.
Final Fantasy 13, remember? That was a huge deal when Microsoft announced at E3 that they had Final Fantasy 13. And people were like, okay, it's been a slow start, obviously. There were a lot of slow starts on Xbox 360. But we know they're coming. We know that as an RPG fan, this is a viable platform for you. Can you say that about Wii U?
Well, sure. I would have loved to see Persona being announced for Wii U, but...
You know, I think there will be some notable indie games in this space. I think Two Brothers is still coming, and that is I think that's in like beta release or whatever they call it, early play on Steam. I don't know that it's fully out yet, but it's playable. I've seen a quick look of it at Giant Bomb, and that game's still coming, and that looks pretty promising. And
but like more than Wii U, like the publishers are getting cold feet releasing stuff on the 3DS. On a fucking 3DS. Mm. And I street pass people who've played Soul Hackers and, you know, Fire Emblem like every day. I get 5-6 people over here who are playing these games daily. I don't understand it. Are they all selling Montreal? Like, what's going on?
No, I mean, Bravely Default sold 200,000 copies in 3 weeks in February. Yeah. So RPGs sell on the system, you know?
100 million copies in Japan.
So where's Dragon Quest VII?
Amen, brother. Exactly. Yeah. I mean, I do think, you know, of course, Bravely Default, there was a long drought before that, outside of Nintendo's own stuff like Mario and Luigi and the Paper Mario game. There wasn't much coming from the third parties for a long time. But But also Bravely Default had been out for a long time in Japan. It was just having, you know, this epic localization. So now that they see the success of that game, I hope they're going to kind of fast track stuff like Dragon Quest VII, because I would totally pay $30, $40 for that. And, you know, there's other things as well, but we'll see. I on 3DS, I'm actually still pretty optimistic that in the end, it's going to have a pretty good library of RPGs. I mean, look at the DS. It had a slow start in that genre, and by the end, it was a powerhouse. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I mean, and there's still the Etrian Odyssey stuff, of course. We're going to get emails if I don't say that, but, you know, there's stuff on the 3DS series for sure.
And just, I'm not sure, also, I'm not convinced that the quality of 3DS RPGs in Japan right now is really up to par with what we saw on the DS, because they seem to be, I don't know, like this generation, Exceed and all those guys seem to be digging into places that they would never have ventured before, like very fan servicey RPGs about...
Oh, no, they were always doing those before. They just weren't bringing them over.
Well, exactly. Yeah. Like, I'm talking about the localizers. It looks like they're like, okay, well, we don't have any choice anymore. There's nothing else. We're going to bring the RPG where you breed the heroes and, like, you breed your party or something.
Or where you run a weapon shop and play a rhythm game to, you know,
well, that's still blacksmithing. That's okay, but, like, the... You know, like Conception 2, like, what is that?
So there's a ton of them on 3DS, but yeah, on Wii U, doesn't look that great. Lots of reasons for that, but my concern is that it may not be getting better. I mean, as long as eventually it gets better, I'm okay waiting. You know, I can be patient for games like this. I'm used to it. But on the horizon right now, I mean, there aren't many Wii U games announced, period, for this year, but RPGs especially are, you know, really scarce. We got the big one with X, but other than that, you know, I wonder, is Nintendo going to do a Paper Mario for Wii U? It seems likely eventually. I don't know how long that'll take. I don't know that that's a game I want to play based on the last couple of those, but I'm curious. Like, I'll listen. You know, it depends on what they do with it.
Sure.
We'll see. I mean, I think Mario, as sad as this is, when they do the GBA Virtual Console in, what, May, I think they said, at least we'll have Mario and Luigi. Which is awesome. Cool. That's a fantastic game. So yeah, I'll probably buy it. But
I have questions about how many games are actually going to come out on that. But
yeah, well, yeah, of course. Of course you do, John. You pay attention.
Yeah.
Well, let's move on to the next topic that I had lined up here. Last week, it sort of came accidentally up in the conversation that we're not really big fans of the way that Smash Brothers is played at tournaments. And I didn't think it was that big of a deal. I thought James, you know, had pretty crazy, vicious reactions, as he often does, to things. You know, I tried to be a little more even-handed with it, but, you know, I made it known that I'm not really a fan of that. I don't think any of us were. We got an incredible number of responses to this, like several emails, lots and lots of forum posts, tweets about it. I was really surprised. And the more I thought about it, it made more sense, because I thought, you know, this is like the overlap of two sort of downtrodden, very sensitive groups of people. You've got the people who are into esports or competitive tournament play or whatever you want to call it, who are used to people not taking what they do very seriously. They're used to having to explain, why is this something that you can make money on? Why is this something that people actually want to spectate?
I don't think it's so much that. It's the fact that Smash Brothers within that crowd, within that community, like, oh, it's not going to be part of Evo this year. Well, why not? That kind of thing.
Well, exactly. It's also the much more temperamental fighting game community and the people who like Smash Brothers within that, which is a subset of a subset of a subset. And they're people, and you know, they're people who play Smash Brothers at tournaments are used to having to defend it against the people who play Marvel and Street Fighter and Mortal Kombat and stuff like that. And now they're having to defend it against us, people who like Smash Brothers. So I can understand the sensitivity of being felt like you're kind of being pinched from different directions. And especially by people like us who they probably feel like should be supportive of what they're doing. I mean, we love Smash Brothers. So why are we giving them shit for playing Smash Brothers at places where people, you know, probably aren't very open to that idea, who really may not take them very seriously? Like, we should be supporting our brothers in Nintendo, right? And I don't think it's about that. And I hope people don't think that we're attacking them or anything. I mean, for me, I probably should have said it more clearly, but you know, I'm glad that people can play this game whatever way they want to. And it, frankly, I'm amazed that it holds up under those very narrow circumstances that people use for tournament play. Like, I'm amazed that in creating this crazy party game with, you know, thousands of different combinations of what can happen, I'm amazed that you can cut it down to such a very limited version, and it actually works as an extremely competitive fighting game. That's just not how I like to play, and I don't really like watching that either. One person, I think it was on the NeoGAF thread, talked, it might have been our talk back, I'm sorry, I don't remember right now, but one person referred us to a documentary called The Smash Brothers. It's on YouTube, you can watch it for free, it's in multiple parts. And I watched the first part of it, and I don't think it's very well made, and I think it's kind of a bad production, but I think it's an interesting topic. And I have to say, I learned a few things about what people get out of this. I especially learned people who are already into fighting games, other kinds of fighting games, I learned how they might migrate into playing Smash Brothers and what they might appreciate about it. Because it is so physics-based, it doesn't necessarily have these predefined combos. It's much more of a, it's much more of an unknown kind of design space in which you have to try to figure out the best ways to do things. And it's not that the designers pre-plan this, which makes it all the more amazing that it does kind of work out as well as it does in a competitive way. Like, I thought that was interesting, and I thought the people, the actual players that you see in the movie, they do a really good job of describing this and of explaining themselves and explaining the game and what makes it cool. Like, I enjoyed that stuff. I still didn't actually enjoy watching them play the game. You know, like, it made me appreciate their love of it and of how they might get into doing something like that, but I still don't think it's very entertaining to watch. And that's, you know, it's so crazy to me because Smash Brothers, I think, is maybe the most entertaining game to watch when played sort of normally, you know, when played in the sort of default setting. It's so gloriously entertaining. And you know, so that's my personal opinion. It doesn't interest me. I'm not saying people shouldn't do it. I don't find it very fun, but obviously people do. And, you know, I'm not treading on that. I didn't mean to in the first place. James, on the other hand, is, you know, brutal and unrepenting. I know.
Yep. I think playing it that, anointing that as the way that it should be played at tournaments is facile and not representative of what the game actually is.
Yeah, I mean, I probably land somewhere in the middle. Like, I can understand how you would want, for competitive purposes, you would want to set a baseline because there is so much random stuff in Smash Brothers.
But to
me, that's kind of indicative of the fact that it's not really a game that is necessarily suitable for tournament play. Like, you can, I mean, it's a fighting game, yeah, but I mean, I'm just saying it's a tournament game, but I mean, you kind of have to shoehorn it into being a tournament game. Like, it's a fighting game, so automatically you can have a tournament with it, but I feel like you kind of have to shoehorn it to get it there. So
they've had to sculpt the experience in some very specific ways in order to make it, you know, quote unquote fair, in order to give people a sort of base set of rules that they can practice within. Because I think part of it is that the breadth of what is possible in Smash Brothers is so vast that as a competitive game, it would be extremely difficult to train yourself playing it with all the items on all the stages with all the characters. I think it would be extremely difficult to ever get good at it. And so this is a way to it's kind of the human nature thing. It's like the need to stratify. You know, when you get a group of people together, you want to feel like the outcome of the tournament actually reflects the order of the skill levels of the players who were in the tournament. Like, people who do tournament stuff who are hyper competitive, they get really obsessed over that.
Yeah.
And
see,
for me,
that is so
uninteresting. Like, for me, the tournament, it exists, it's its own thing. Whatever happens within it happens within it. And all the weird, surprising, dramatic moments of, you know, crazy turnarounds and like lucky wins and shitty, you know, accidentally falling off the platform or whatever. To me, all that stuff is what makes it great. But I also understand the other perspective.
The argument, though, that the quote randomness in some way diminishes the skill of the player, though, is, you know, on face value, invalid, because you need to be able to react to that randomness to avoid, oh crap, a bomb spawned, I need to get out of the way. You need to have awareness and reaction, which are skills that are pivotal in fighting games.
Yeah, I agree.
I think the argument that by having things like items and stage hazards on somehow diminishes the skill or diminishes the impact of skill. I think it's entirely backwards. I think people who make that argument have hemmed themselves in to a version of the game that is so incredibly reductionist and so clearly not representative of how the average person plays the game that they have sort of indoctrinated themselves in this idea that random equals no skill. This isn't a game where it punishes people who are playing well. This isn't Mario Kart. This is a game where everybody has the possibility of feeling the effects of items. Dealing with items is part of the core strategy of playing Smash Brothers. And the fact of the matter is, the scoring system in Smash Brothers, where losing doesn't reset everybody back to 100% health, where you can go on runs because you may lose, you may get knocked out of the stage and immediately come back and be able to knock someone out who got you and reset, and basically reset everybody back. The fact that you can hang on at really high levels of damage, all of that stuff helps mitigate any randomness the items cause. I would say that saying items and hazards make the game unbalanced is thinking about it backwards. Playing the game in a way that says, well, this is how you play the game without having items and hazards on to make it balanced, sort of reduces the game to what it isn't. It sort of says,
yeah, and
this...
you're putting words into the critics' mouths a little bit, you know.
No,
and
I'm not.
I'm sure that they wouldn't give you those exact phrases, you know, like saying, you know, random equals no skill. I don't think that tournament players really believe that. I think you might be reducing their kind of views of the game, or they're not, and these aren't people telling us how to play the game.
No,
but
I'm saying,
unless I register for a tournament, you know, if I register for a tournament, there are rules of that tournament and they have established the boundaries of that. And in that case, they are telling me how to play the game. And again, that's kind of what bothers me because I feel like I'm okay at Smash Bros. I don't think I would ever win a tournament, but I think it would be fun to participate, but it wouldn't be fun for me to participate in the tournaments that are actually out there.
This kind of, you know, the blessing of this incredibly niche version of the game that maybe 0.1% thinks is the most fun way to play effectively isolates everybody else from being able to play the game in a tournament setting the way that they like to play it. I feel like you're going to do a tournament, a game that is this popular and this well liked, and the intention is it's for public consumption, i.e. that they should be viewing it. You should be playing the game in the way that the public would want to consume it. It should be representative of the game that they play. If you turn off hazards and items, you are effectively playing a different game.
Hmm. I see what you're getting at. I don't know that I completely agree with that. But, you know, I think, to be honest, James, you and I, we both feel pretty strongly about this, although to different degrees. But I think you and I might be a little defensive ourselves because we feel that we are good at this game, at the version that we play.
I'm not good at Smash Brothers. I don't feel I'm good at it at all. I'm terrible.
Okay, well,
Smash
maybe
Brothers.
It's just me. I do feel defensive. Like, I feel like when people talk about how good they are, or they go to tournaments and they, you know, they have the awards and the medals to prove it, the cash prizes, whatever, but they play this very, very specific version, I feel like there is kind of a conflict between my own sense of pride over my Smash Brothers skills, which are modest. But, you know, like within my group of friends, I'm pretty good. I can often win. You know, even when we go to E3 and we hook it up in the hotel, I'm okay. I'm at least better than average. So, like, I do feel a certain pride in that. And yet what my capabilities would be completely useless in a tournament. Like, I don't even, based on their version of the game, I don't even know how to play at all.
That's what I'm saying. It's basically playing a different game.
They're playing a different game, which is amazing that they have created a completely different experience out of the same disc that you and I bought. But at the same time, it's like, I wish I could participate, you know, like that it comes down to, if I didn't care about tournaments, if I didn't care about Smash Brothers, none of this would bother me at all. I do care. And I feel like I'm okay. And I think it would be fun to compete, even though I would never win, but I can't because I don't play that version of the game. So I feel left out. You know, that's why it bothers me. I'm not angry about it. I'm kind of sad.
To me, I look at this as this kind of blessing of a version of the game that isn't what the people who play the game, the majority of the people who play the game, play default settings.
Yeah.
And this is a group of people saying we are the public face of what Smash Brothers is, and they're not. It's basically a version of it's saying this is the game. But it's not. It's not the game for the vast majority of people who play it. And I feel like if you're going to say, well, this is how the game is going to be played in these public settings, you should probably make an effort to represent how the average person sees this game. You shouldn't hem it down to this super incredibly restrictive version of the game that I would say the average person watching it would, A, as you said, find kind of dull, and B, they wouldn't recognize as the game they love.
Well, see, I think what Nintendo would be smart to do would be to actually have a tournament mode that catered to these people instead of having it as like this kind of backwater mode that you have to,
It's not a mode. You just turn settings off.
Well, that's the thing, though. There could obviously be better ways that they could make all characters useful in this mode as opposed to a few that are favored. You know, there's a lot of things that they could do.
Or they could make it so there's this mode, and then when they detect you're playing it at EVO, all the items turn on, and they're all bombs. And they all spawn instantly.
No, come on.
Yeah, I don't think that Nintendo can reasonably be expected to balance a game, like, balance all the characters for two different modes.
Apparently
they did accidentally is the feeling. Like, one of the, you know, I think of tournament as being basically you're going to see the same one or two characters and everything, and that's not uncommon in other fighting games.
Third Strike is notorious for having like three characters that are really good.
Yeah, I mean that's not unusual, but actually one thing we heard from people over the week is that you'd be surprised in that actually there's probably at least six or eight characters at any given time who are successful at the tournament level. And I was really surprised by that. I did not know that. And in the movie as well, in the first part, you can hear them talking about it. And if you think about it, they're playing mostly Melee, right? That game is now over a decade old and has never been patched. Like, it cannot be patched. And the fact that people are still playing it and they're still discovering new strategies and they're still – basically the game is rebalancing itself under their very strict environment over time. It is still – like, there's so much depth to this game that they're still finding new ways to play it, and they're still finding that different characters have different advantages than were known even 10 years ago. That's incredible. Like, it's kind of accidentally amazing. Like, Nintendo did not really intentionally do it that way. I think it's kind of an artifact of the physics-based fighting engine that they have and of the sort of, I don't know if dial a combo is the technical term, but you sort of make your own combos based on the way that the moves string together. There's nothing really pre-planned in the game. It's absolutely astonishing that the game can actually support that kind of thing. So I have a lot of respect for it. I don't know that... You know, and it's funny. Excuse me, I'm getting groggy. Froggy.
You that opened the can.
But it's funny that Brawl didn't really satisfy a lot of tournament players because, you know, they felt that it was a little too random, even when you do turn all that stuff off. And to some extent, that was intentional. You know, Sakurai kind of, you know, throwing them a finger. And I'll be very, very curious to find out with the new Smash Brothers games if they kind of roll back on that a little bit. Maybe they, you know, maybe it's a little less trolly to the tournament scene, and maybe it's something that they got. You know, I'm sure there's a significant audience that Nintendo would like to sell to. So if you at least make it possible to play it the way that they want to play it, that would be good for sales. You know, it might be measurable. I'll also be very curious to find out if they end up favoring one version over the other, 3DS versus Wii U. You know, is one of them a little bit like, can a 3DS game be good at tournaments? Is that even logistically feasible? I don't know.
I would say logistics will probably mean the Wii U version would be favored.
Yeah, probably, because you don't have to worry about the wireless communication back and forth.
Well, you don't have to worry about trying to capture the video either.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, in the Smash Brothers documentary, they don't capture video in that one either. It's all off screen, which is a big part of my issue with
Woo,
the movie.
Yeah. Production
yeah,
values.
It looks real bad. but yeah, you're probably right. I think it will be Wii U, but I think it also depends on the gameplay balancing. Anyway, I wanted to acknowledge all the feedback that we received, and I really do appreciate it. And some people were kind of pissed, and they felt that we had been rude, or I should say specifically that James had been very rude about the top. I know you don't. I care. I don't want our show to piss off people. Like, I want us to be inclusive, you know? And I want us to always explain ourselves adequately, which I'm not sure that I did last week, which is why I wanted to revisit this. But I do really appreciate all the very patient emails and forum posts that we got about people saying, look, I think you guys are slagging on something that you don't really understand. and trying to educate us. And, you know, there was some factual data that I found really interesting. I think I understood it before. I think I still understand it, but I certainly have learned more about the topic, and I have at the very least, it gave me more respect for the game itself. You know, the fact that it does support this style of play completely unintentionally is fascinating. Like, I think that's amazing. It really does reinforce that Melee is one of the greatest games of all time. It, you know, in my opinion, easily up there. And that's me having, you know, no interest in playing it that way. I don't ever have to play it in the tournament style, and I can still think it's one of my favorite games of all time. So that's how good it is. You know, it was a finalist, I think, in our Game of the Decade discussion, wasn't it?
Probably.
I think it was up there with Metroid Prime and...
I think I totally checked out by that point. Because being the only one who had any good taste, I was losing all the votes.
Poor guy. I know you love WarioWare. I love it too, but it doesn't belong in that discussion, I don't think.
Twisted absolutely belongs in that discussion.
Super interesting premise.
WarioWare Twisted is unbelievable. It is the best minigame collection ever made.
All right, buddy. All right, so let's move on to our third and final sort of special topic here. I don't know if this will take as much time, but I think it's super interesting, and I wanted to talk about it because our good old friend, Mr. Koji Igarashi.
Oh, God.
Yeah, used to be known as Mr. Castlevania.
He pulled his way onto the stage.
I have this guy's business card in which it is a cosplay. Actually, no, I think it's art. I think it is a drawn illustration of him sitting on Dracula's throne holding a cup of blood. It is the greatest business card ever printed.
Yeah, see, I also have my own piece of kind of Iga sort of fandom, but for some reason, this was years ago, a Konami PR rep, they couldn't send us a review copy of one of the Castlevania games, and I don't remember which one.
So they bullwhipped you in the face.
No,
instead.
Get this. So in the mail, completely randomly, I get a package with this like kind of, I open it up and it's like this, it's almost like something that would hold a map, right? Like picture like a
frame, a book? What are you talking about?
Like a satchel kind of thing. It was actually made of cardboard, but it looked like something that would hold like a book inside of it with like a wax seal on it. And I'm like, what the hell is this thing, right? And so I open it up.
Like a vellum envelope.
Kind of, yeah. But I open it up, and there was, and inside of it, there was like a little notebook. Like it was just like an empty notebook, but it was like Castlevania and everything. But also in the package was a Castlevania, like an art print. And he had signed it in like, with like a silver marker. And I was just like, what the hell? This is an auto, like, what the hell? They just randomly sent me like autograph stuff from Iga. I was like, okay.
Iga is interesting in that if you ever attend E3, you will eventually encounter Iga. Mm-hmm. And that's not to say that...
And you'll have a bullwhip.
He's everywhere. Yeah, it's that he has somehow managed to get past the LACC weapons prohibitions. And he has essentially been doing Castlevania so long, he believes he lives in that world. It's the only other... The only other person I could think of that kind of does this is Toshihiro Nagoshi.
I was about to say the same thing. He seems a little bit too into it, right?
As he's taken over the Yakuza series, has begun to transform himself into the stereotypical depiction of someone in the Yakuza, including like the fake orange tan, the leopard skin, the leopard skin coat with fur lining, the spiked up hair. I mean,
I think he got tattoos even.
Oh, he's got tats. He wears muscle shirts.
Oh yeah.
He's way too into this, and
tattoos are a very, very strong like Yakuza symbol in Japan. There's a huge stigma against people who have tattoos, even if they're not Japanese. People will get in trouble. You can be fired from your job for showing a tattoo.
I don't think he got a big back tattoo, which is the big Yakuza tie-in. But I mean, he's like,
is he missing a pinky finger?
No, like they're just way too into what they've been making. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, Iga is so awesome. I mean, he does it ironically. He does it because he knows people know who he is. He knows he is so enthusiastic about Castlevania. He loves it. Even now, he loves it. And I think he was just playing it up, getting attention. It was good marketing for his games in the West. And people liked it. You know, I have a photo of me standing with Iga holding his whip, and it's awesome. So,
oh my God.
Oh, totally. Ridiculous. Absolutely, man. I've interviewed Iga about Judgment of all things, but I talked about other Castlevania games as much as possible.
Let's talk about Judgment.
Yeah, let's
fucking talk about Judgment. That's how you should have started the interview.
Actually, my favorite thing about this week is that he sat down for an interview after he quit Konami. That's the big news, which we haven't even mentioned yet, is that he left Konami, which is, he'd been there for, I think, 22 years, which is, you know, crazy in itself, but also publicly leaving a big publisher in Japan is very rare. It is almost not done.
There's been a run of those, though.
True, but...
Yeah, he's not the first
It seems to be a new trend. It seems to be like people are like, you know what?
Absolutely, it is. Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, I mean, you saw what happened with Capcom where they had a bunch of people leave. Mm-hmm. And the high point of that was obviously Inafune. But, I mean, they had all the people who were working over at what was at the time Clover, who... All right, see y'all later. Bye.
True. Yeah, that was very high profile, very unusual in Japan for something like that to happen.
And I mean, to the news, I assume that he's really trying to follow the Inafune mold here, where he's left.
Which is awesome.
And he doesn't have a series, but I'll figure it out.
What I love about it is if you'd asked me who is the next person, who's the next big Japanese game developer that you would love to defect and be released from the bonds of his traditional Japanese publisher, I would have said Iga. He is number one on my list.
Well,
absolutely.
And it makes sense,
I want this guy out on his own doing awesome, crazy 2D Castlevania-like games. And
like Metroid.
That's probably exactly what's going to happen now. He's going to kickstart something badass, and I am so pumped.
Yep. And it makes sense that he did leave, because ultimately he's been kind of cut out from the Castlevania franchise.
Yeah, he was kind of pushed aside.
Yeah,
the Warner office.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't even know what he was doing for the last couple
He was
years.
Working on Facebook games, which he claims even now after he's left the company, he says that he didn't mind that. He enjoyed it. He thought it was interesting. He wanted to learn about this new, you know, sort of business model in games. So, you know, I don't think he was necessarily unhappy, but obviously he felt there was something to be gained from going out and being independent. And it is very much a new frontier. And you have to I put myself in his shoes a little bit thinking – this is scary. Like, this is a big deal in Japan. Basically disrupting your career midstream. He's in his 40s, you know. He says, look, if I'm going to do this, now is the time.
Right.
But that is a very dramatic thing to do.
I mean,
and even in America, that's a big deal. But Japan, it's such
20s.
A cultural taboo, you know, that, you know, it's a really a big deal.
Well, he said his games kept getting canceled. That's why the games he would make were too hardcore for the kinds of games they wanted him to make.
Oh my God!
So he said like about three of them got canceled at least.
Yeah, but I mean, I don't know that that's. I mean, it depends on how far along they were. If they were just concepts, then them getting canceled really, that's feedback. If they were like nearly done games, that's a statement.
Well,
probably
I mean, if
somewhere
in the middle. The thing is though, if he's bringing concepts to them and they're saying nope, nope. Nope. Obviously, there's a disconnect there.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, you have to wonder if there's maybe some kind of...
Maybe they weren't getting in the way of the door.
Some kind of larger scheme. Yeah.
Yeah.
So anyway, you know, a lot of people kind of speculating about what he might do. He hasn't really let on yet what his plans are. But he definitely wants to make a game on his own, independently, you know, maybe hire a few people, but make kind of a smaller thing. He's definitely considering Kickstarter. He said he might go with venture capital, which is more what Inafune did, I think, when he kind of broke off and did his own thing. And that's, you know, Level 5 started out that way too. It was like people, I think, left Square and decided to make their own company and became the biggest Japanese publisher. So we will see. I think we'll be talking about this man for a long time to come. I think he's a super interesting guy, very, very talented. Obviously, he makes games that I love. He makes one of my favorite kinds of games. So I am very excited to see him do something new. And frankly, it's been 10 years since the last 2D Metroid game. More than 10 years since Zero Mission. I would absolutely love for this guy to partner up with Nintendo, kind of the way Sakurai has done, and a few other people. Mizuguchi did it at one point, you know, he's making Meteos for Nintendo, and I would absolutely love for them to kind of bring on Igarashi and say, we want you to, you know, collab with Mr. Sakamoto and make that awesome, make that awesome 2D Metroid game that people are going crazy about. It doesn't have to be a big budget thing. You know, it could be a small team, but it would get a lot of attention with these guys together. Like, this would be kind of the Chrono Trigger of Metroid games, you know? I mean, it would be awesome.
So it would be amazing. I really want that that's the first thing I thought. I was like, oh my God, 2D Metroid, please, please make that happen. Oh,
but,
please,
okay.
Please, please.
I guess I'm going to interrupt the Iga Love Fest, but I'm, in other circumstances, if we were living in a world where there were still Metroid games being made, 2D Metroid games being made, I would say,
Grinch.
I'm not sure. No, but I'm not sure if Iga is the person that I would turn to make a good Metroid game.
Look, Samus is going to have bullwhipping action. It's going to be great.
And
about it.
It's going to have, like, halls that, you know, connect unconnected places. I mean, like, it's going to have, like, really weird and disjointed cave design, or I don't know. It's going to have a library in the middle of Zebes.
<that's fine.
laughs> A library in the middle of Zebes.
Yeah, I just don't know.
Maybe I'll tell you where the dumbass keys are hidden.
I wouldn't put the design of most Castlevania games up there with the design of Super Metroid. But then again, I wouldn't put the design of most Metroid games up there with Super Metroid. So
right.
Yeah. And Symphony of the Night, I think, remains like one of the top games of that genre. But that was a long time ago. And Super Metroid
was a long time ago. Iga was not necessarily the creative driving force behind Symphony of the Night.
He was very young when that game came out.
He was younger. He worked on it. I think he might have come in a little bit later in the project, so I don't know that he was one of the originators. He was very involved, and, you know, he sort of took over the reins of Castlevania after that game, and obviously continued to make games in sort of a similar template. So he was very much the torchbearer, not necessarily the inventor of the whole Metroidvania thing. But obviously, I agree with you. I don't think his games are as polished. I don't think they are overall as good. I think they're uneven. Yeah, obviously, between GBA and DS, there are six of these things. And some are significantly better than others. Like, some of them are okay at best. Some of them are amazing. But I think within that are a couple of absolutely amazing games. I think he has it within him, given the right resources. And I think pairing him up with Nintendo and the experts there who know how to do this kind of stuff, with a guy like Sakamoto who keep him far away from writing the story, but designing the game.
Oh, no,
I think he
writing the Metroid story. Please.
He totally knows what he's doing. Pair them up with a team like Intelligent Systems that has absolutely the technical and the design know-how to pull this together.
They have better things to be doing. Literally anything else. I want Sakamoto writing the story, and I want a minimum number of references to the baby. Otherwise, no dice.
Yeah, no.
And that minimum is 500. 500 baby references.
I think this could be made. Look, I mean, I'm not predicting anything. I think, you know, I usually don't get my way with Nintendo. They usually don't do what I think they should do. But, you know, the possibilities out there. And even if what he does has, you know, has nothing to do with Metroid, I think there's a very, very, very good chance it will come to a Nintendo platform. So I think we can at least look forward to that. Just like Mighty No. 9, just like Shovel Knight, you know, these games that are very similar to games that you know from Nintendo systems, and also the new one of those is coming to your Wii U and your 3DS. That is something that we should all be excited about. And whatever Iga does, I hope that we hear about it, you know, sooner rather than later, even though it's probably going to be a long way off. It's probably like 2 years away. But I'm still really excited because I like that guy. I like the games that he makes. So ending on a positive note, at least for me and part of the crew here. So I think we've run out of time, guys. I don't think we're going to get to listener mail this week. We've gotten a lot of it, and some of it is real weird, and some of it's really, really fascinating. Perfect. So we will probably try to do that next week. We'll catch up a little bit. Thank you, everyone, for writing. Please keep writing in. We're collecting them. We don't forget anybody, I promise you. The address is rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. And by the way, you can get a link to send us an email on our show notes over at the website. While you're there, there will also be a link to the retroactive poll. If you haven't already voted, I really hope you will. There's going to be a couple days left after this podcast goes live. So if you're not listening to this way, way, way after the fact, I hope you will participate. Go vote in the retroactive poll. We're going to play one of five games on Nintendo Wi-Fi Connection. There's one DS game and four Wii games. Most of them are pretty popular, especially in America. They're pretty easy to get. If you're in Europe, some of them a little bit harder, but you know, love will find a way. I know it did for Greg and some other people as well. So, whatever wins, it's going to be fun. We're going to play it online, hopefully with some of you. And, you know, depending on the game, we might even get to voice chat a little bit. So, I'm really looking forward to it. I think it will be, you know, we will be talking about the game, but also we'll be talking about the online experience. And so it's kind of a 2-for-1. Should be really interesting, and I'm looking forward to it no matter what wins. So if you haven't voted yet, please go make your selection. Let us know what you think, because we want you to play with us. We want this to be something that a lot of our listeners are into. So looking forward to that. Like I said, voting will end soon. We'll announce the winner on next week's show. So don't miss out. Finally, before we go, one thing that we didn't mention last week when Greg was here is that he is on the latest episode of Radio Trivia. It's over 2 hours long, which is how you can tell it's a Greg episode, and it's really good, which is another way you can tell. So, they really pull out some gems, some games that you would have thought we would have used many years ago and somehow didn't happen, and some newer stuff too. So it's a really great episode. I know people love Greg. I know people always want to hear more from him. There may be even yet another opportunity to do that soon, but I don't have anything to announce right now. But he is on Radio Trivia. And if you don't listen to Radio Trivia, what the hell is wrong with you? Please go do that. It's so good. And, this is an excellent way to get into it. And then you can go back and, you know, they're not really timely in that sense. You can go back and listen to them whenever you want. They never get old. They never get tired. They're always great. So please go check that out as well. We'll probably put a link to that in the show notes as well. And of course, you can find all that stuff over at our website, NintendoWorldReport.com. So please do that. And we'll talk to you next week, guys. Peace out.
Later.
Later.
Bye. Level 44. Right. Level 44 in Yumi's Odd Odyssey.
44? Because
the numbers jump around.
But I beat in, like, I don't know, like 25 levels.
Yeah, so we'll definitely talk about it next week or the week after that. So anyway, let's move on to, I guess, pretty quickly what John's been playing or
nothing.
What is your status?
Maybe that's my status.
3DS yeah. status update, please.
What you been shipping, John?
Well, yeah, the broken 3DS is shipped off, and it is in the greasy palms of of Nintendo of America somewhere. In the bowels of the machine that is Nintendo of America, it is being worked on by, I'm sure, the best people that they can find. So who knows how that's going to come back. They did ship me out a loner 3DS. Perfect. Because I'm so important. But of course...
Hey, John, you should call in from your phone.
Oh, am I getting shitty? Am I getting bad?
He's laughing now. He's having a good time.
Am I okay? Or is it really choppy?
Yeah, we really can't understand you. It cuts off for long stretches, so...
All right.
Well, we could tell you were having fun.
Yeah, you're off to a good start. I'm sure it's good. It's good. Good material, but
yeah. All right. Well, I don't really know what to do because I'll have recording. To completely drop off the call.
Yeah,
that's fine. But just keep recording.
Just keep recording.
Yeah.
All right.
The delay in him saying "all right" is terrifying.
Yeah, it's brutal.
Oh,
I could hear him trying to get in on the Yumi's discussion, and by the time we heard anything, someone had already been speaking for 10 seconds, and it wasn't, you know.
Well, just for the record, during John's Skype troubles, I unlocked stages 10 and 11 of Yumi's Odd Odyssey. So,
congrats.
We're probably going to talk it more.
James Jones.
It's so easy. I can't imagine anyone would have a problem.
Easy.
Yeah.
Whatever.
We'll talk about the game more next week. I like it.
Oh, that made me so happy right now.
Fucking dumb piece of fucking shit. That pisses me off, dude. Because now I gotta fucking burn my fucking my quote-unquote unlimited shit. That's just fucking annoying. I'm tired of this shit. That's all what I'm saying to you. Just pisses me off. It's fucking dumb. I gotta fucking MacGyver this fucking bullshit.